Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Marianne Daddy Burke, the Executive Director of Dignity USA, the leading organization for LGBT Catholics, and look into the Pope's surprising remarks to reporters that if a person is gay and looks for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge them? And we'll also speak with gay political activist Mike Rogers, the managing director of Raw Story, about Vladimir Putin's moves in the opposite direction as his anti-gay crackdown takes on darker and sinister tones. We'll discuss growing calls for a boycott on Russian products and the Sochi Winter Olympics. Then we will speak with economist James Galbraith about the coming showdown over raising the debt limit, which the president has vowed is non-negotiable. We will discuss the House Republicans' intention to tie a debt ceiling increase to spending cuts in the name of deficit reduction and the White House's new focus on job creation to reverse income inequality and restore economic opportunity for working Americans. Then finally, with more clashes in Egypt between supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and the army, we will speak with Carrie Wickham, a professor of political science at Emory University and author of The Muslim Brotherhood, Evolution of an Islamist Movement. She has a recent article at the New York Times examining the inner workings of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's Lost Opportunity. And joining us now is Marianne Daddy Burke, the Executive Director of Dignity USA, the leading organization of LGBT Catholics, their families, friends, and allies. Her recent article at the Huffington Post is Catholic Church Unfriendly to LGBT People, No Living a Split Reality, examines the perceptions and reality of the relationship between the LGBT community and the Catholic Church. And also joining us is Mike Rogers, a gay political activist, blogger, and the vice chairman and managing director of Raw Story, Inc. He is a leading subject of the 2009 film Outrage on the subject of outing closeted politicians. And in 2008, he founded the National Blogger and Citizens Journalist Initiative, now known as the Netroots Connect program of Netroots Nation, where he serves as director. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Rogers and Marianne Daddy Burke.
Thanks for having us.
And Marianne, let me begin with you, since the Pope is making news here and aboard the aeroplane where he was on his way back from Brazil to Rome. Apparently, he caught the press by surprise and was extremely freewheeling. He even thanked the reporter who asked him the question that precipitated this comment. He thanked the reporter who asked him about reports of a gay lobby inside the Vatican. And this led to this extraordinary comment on the part of the Pope. So does this – but the real question is, does this apply to just Catholic priests? Was that the context? Or does this apply to all gays?
Well, Ian, from what I've heard from folks who were on the plane reporting about their experience, it sounds as if the question was directed to the Pope about priests initially, but then he broadened his comments to include LGBT people who are lay as well as in the priesthood of the Catholic Church.
So, what leads you to feel that? Because there was a comment, I guess, that indicated a broader understanding and appreciation of all people. So, what exactly led you to that conclusion that he said?
Well, what he said was that, you know, if gay people are or if a gay person is, you know, seeking Jesus and a person of goodwill, who am I to judge them? And again, I've heard from a number of people who were on the plane who felt as if he was talking quite expansively about that. And it certainly has been received out in the world in that way. People, gay and lesbian Catholics, and our families have definitely seen themselves as being included in that remark from the head of the church.
Right. Well, I think the quote that I've seen that indicates a broader understanding that may include all of humanity, not just the clergy and priests in the Catholic Church. the Pope said, the tendency to homosexuality is not the problem. They are our brothers. So is that a remark that gives you some sense that there's a sea change underway?
That, and also, you know, he did go on to talk about the fact that gay people should not be marginalized in society, which, you know, is obviously a very broad context. Is it a sea change? It doesn't seem to be so on the policy side of things or the official church teaching side of things. But what I think people have been remarking upon, and that certainly struck me, was the vast difference in tone from Pope Francis than what we've heard under the other two popes. You know, for the Pope to speak about LGBT people as people of faith, as people of goodwill, you know, as folks who should not be marginalized by society, to put the emphasis there rather than on the kinds of horrific things we've heard from his predecessors, you know, that called us a threat to civilization or people who do violence to children, you know, it has a very different impact out in the world.
Let me bring in Mike Rogers, a gay political activist, blogger, and vice chairman and managing director of Raw Story, Inc. Mike, what's your take on what the Pope said?
Well, I certainly agree in as much as there is, you know, this does affect the kind of things in social change, the way that people are perceiving it and the way that it's being taken. I think if you do read contextually everything he said, I don't know if it's as great as all the headlines say, but the fact that people are taking it as he's being much more opening and accepting is, of course, a good thing. I, of course, can't speak. I'm not a Catholic, so I can't speak to that experience, but I do know that many of my fellow LGBT activists who are Catholic are happy and see this as somewhat of a level of progress.
Well, the Pope himself, of course, is not without problems. And his own, the person that he appointed as one of his advisors to look into the Vatican Bank, has been accused in the Italian press of having a gay tryst and it being a part of the so-called gay lobby or the gay mafia, as it's been called. And also the Pope's accountant, apparently, this is not somewhat different subject, he's been suspended, he's been arrested for involvement in a plot to bring in 20 million euros from Switzerland. So how much is this, you think, a blip in terms of the broader issues that are going on surrounding this church that has been beset by so much scandal involving pedophilia?
I think this is a significant departure from the way these kinds of things were handled in the past. I mean, you know, the fact that the Pope chose to speak openly about homosexuality and hasn't dodged questions about the other kinds of scandals, that he has made it clear that he needs help in governing the church and has set up a worldwide council of eight cardinals from around the nations around the world, you know, it says that things are happening a little bit differently at the Vatican than what we're used to, you know, where everything was clothed in secrecy and there was just no willingness to address problems with any kind of light upon them. You know, obviously we're still in the early days of that, but, you know, I am paying attention to the fact that this shift is there and would like to be able to see it continue.
Well, of course, the Pope did reiterate that his predecessor had, at least Pope John Paul II, had definitively closed the door on female ordination. And many people argue that if priests were able to marry and women, nuns were able to be ordained, a lot of the Catholic Church's problems would go away. But he apparently has reiterated that the door is closed in that regard, although he talked about a theology of women and a greater role for women inside Catholic life. Let me turn to Mike Rogers then and discuss the opposite side of the story. If there's any hope to be gained from the Pope's remark, there's absolute darkness coming from Russia and from Vladimir Putin. Fill us in, if you will, Mike, on what you understand about this Russian parliament in June passing a bill banning propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations, which has led to a kind of open season on gays, on gay tourists. Dutch activists filming a documentary were arrested in Murmansk, and six LGBT activists were arrested in Moscow. This could turn really ugly, and the Canadian government, in fact, have issued a travel alert for gay visitors to Russia.
And recently the American government as well joined in that, and it's quite scary. It's, you know, this is Putin's Russia. It passed unanimously. Imagine that. In addition to creating this environment that has just made it an unbelievable attack on gay youth being lured into situations and then being physically abused, I mean, it's just gone on to the point where it's really as bad as some things that have happened throughout history, and you would think in modern times people would know better, but Putin needs to make somebody a scapegoat for his country's problems, and he's now blaming the gays for creating an environment where the Russian population is declining. He's blaming that on the gay community, and therefore he can now blame the economy and saying, well, there's not enough of us to work, so therefore the gay people are destroying the country. And in addition to jail time and all of the other things, even people who are found to be gay, but even the biological parents, their child can be taken away from them if they're found out to be gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender. So it's a really scary situation, and people don't really know what we can do about it.
Well, Harvey Fierstein had a piece in the New York Times recently that was very powerful. Piece of writing, and he basically compared the 2013 Russia, the Sochi Olympics coming up, the Winter Olympics, with the German Olympics in 1936, making the point that back in 1936, very few of the people that showed up from around the world for the 36 Olympics said a word about Hitler's campaign against the Jews. And he is, in fact, calling for a boycott of the Sochi Winter Olympics. What's your response?
Boycotts are very complicated things, and one of the things that I hope for is that there can be an Olympics free from politics. That will never happen, of course, in reality. But when I think of the opportunities and the change that has been made of folks in, you know, and it wasn't just in Germany where a difference was made socially via society at the Olympics. People have held up fists throughout history and you know, a whole lot of things that have gone on, but the people who don't show up can't create change. The IOC, the real pressure point here needs to be on the IOC to ask them, why are you putting these Olympics in places that are so unbelievably oppressive? Why is that allowed?
And the
boycott question is confusing, and it's one that I think there's definitely valid points on both sides. I think right now I would support attending the Olympics and moving this through media as far and wide as it can go.
And let me ask Marion Duddy Burke, what's your response to what's happening in Russia compared to the glimmer of hope coming from the Vatican compared to the darkness descending Russia?
Well, you know, it is interesting, and I think there is a connection. I actually was recently in Europe just 2 months ago for a meeting of LGBT Christian groups there and met with Russian activists who talked about their fears of this law passing and as well as the experiences that we're having. I mean, every single Russian person that I'd met with had been beaten at some point because of the suspicions that they were being gay. They'd suffered horrendous trauma and horrible things happening to them. Their places had been burned, you know, just all sorts of horrible things. The conditions are terrible. And the failure of religious leaders to speak out against this kind of violence, to be accountable for the hateful rhetoric or harsh damaging rhetoric that so many of them are responsible for, you know, including leaders of my own church. You know, they need to be confronted with these stories and to acknowledge the role that they've played in it. And then they need to be the ones who are working against things like, you know, Putin's law and what's going on in Uganda and in other countries where folks are trying to make being gay, you know, a capital crime. You know, the religious institutions have enormous power in many, many countries, and their failure to act is really a sin.
And Mark Rogers, what do you think of the calls to boycott Stolichnaya, popular vodka, in spite of the fact that the CEO of Stolichnaya, Val Mendeleev, posted an open letter to the LGBT community in saying that the recent dreadful actions taken by the Russian government limiting the rights of the LGBT community, they completely abhor. So I don't know whether he's a businessman trying to save his business, but it sounds like there are a lot of people in Russia that aren't reactionaries and in the way that Putin is fanning the flames to the lowest common denominator.
There was a lawsuit in international court over who actually controls the Stolichnaya name. And that's shifting this year, so it's been very convenient for everybody to be able to say, we are this, we're not this. But I think what's most important in this is that all too often American activists can stand up and say, this is what we're going to do. Well, how about everybody slowing down and asking our Russian brothers and sisters what they need us to do, as opposed to us coming into a country and saying, this is what we are going to do for you. So I hope, and I've seen that new level of cooperation, but with organizations like we talked about the churches, and there are good religious institutions working on these things, there is All Out, which is the new international organization, and the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. So for us to work with folks like that and your visit to Russia, to provide for them what they need is, I think, the best way that we can move forward, as opposed for us to decide what to boycott and what not to. The Russian activists have made it clear that boycotting Stoli will do nothing. So we can have a boycott, but the people who we're trying to help have told us, pretty much put out there, that it's a waste of an effort. And I would rather see some real change than practically a whole bunch of people boycotting something they probably don't drink in the first place. And these companies are pretty smart.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Mike Rogers, a gay political activist, blogger, and vice chairman and managing director of Raw Story, Inc., and Marion Duddy Burke, the executive director of Dignity USA, the leading organization of LGBT Catholics, their families, friends, and allies. I thank you both for helping us see both some hope and some darkness here that needs to be addressed. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with economist James Galbraith.
Ooh, love breaks the machine. Everything's half a dream. How can it be? Everything's born in shame. It's not just me. Particle wave duality. How can we ever evolve when our gods are so primitive? They destroy our hope for peace, hope for love.
My bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James K. Galbraith, the professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Welcome to Background Briefing. Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good to be with you.
And clearly the showdown is looming between the White House and the Congress, who have threatened, John Boehner has threatened that he will tie the debt ceiling increase to spending cuts in the name of deficit reduction. And on the other side, the White House is saying they have a new focus on job creation to reverse income inequality and restore economic opportunity for working Americans. What's going to happen with this collision, this game of chicken, do you think?
Oh, I think it will pass. I don't think anybody can really take the Republican position that seriously, in particular because all of this, talk about the deficit as being a huge problem has proven to be so much smoke. The deficit has basically fallen very quickly, even with the very slow rates of economic growth that we have. So it's become, I think, a little bit embarrassing for all of those who were saying that we were becoming the next Greece and otherwise going to hell in a handbasket on account of the deficits, to find that this problem is vanishing from the news.
Well, the House is going on vacation for the month of August and coming back on September the 9th. They're going on vacation on Friday, but not before taking their 40th vote to cripple Obamacare. I mean, does the public...
How many of those had any effect on the program at all? I think the answer to that is zero.
Right.
The House can vote all it wants, and so long as the Senate doesn't go along and so long as the President doesn't sign any bills... It's an exercise in a very empty form of theater.
But it is apparently going to be sometime in September that the debt ceiling is reached, and apparently it was actually reached in May, according to the Secretary of Treasury Jack Lew, who said that we've been using extraordinary measures since May to pay our bills. We'll do that as long as we can. Apparently, as long as we can is up until early September when they come back from their vacation.
Well, now we could have some disruption to, I suppose, some things as a result of the games being played in the Congress. But I think any political figure that seriously threatened the full faith and credit of the United States over an effort to insist on some particular political outcome is taking their political life in their hands at this point. I don't think the American public is impressed by the threat that the United States is going to breach the debt ceiling, which, after all, was raised how many times? I've forgotten now, 17 times in the administration of the sainted Ronald Reagan. It's not it's a charade which has been played out so many times in the past that I find it very difficult to believe that anybody will panic over it this time.
But they did in 2011 go to the mat, and the president folded and came up with this sequester and this whole mechanism. And unfortunately, at the press at the time didn't speak of it in terms of it being unprecedented and reckless. They basically, because of as is their way, they said, and on the one hand, on the other hand, you weren't. They didn't really punish the Republicans. Maybe the American people figured
that. What happened in 2011 was the compromises and the destructive compromises that were taken. Were taken because the White House was prepared to make them, and the White House now has I think at least is moving in the direction of making the argument that it shouldn't compromise on this issue, and that the political responsibility will fall entirely on the Republicans in Congress if they choose to play the same game, and I think that's a much stronger hand. At the time, the political argument in the hands of the deficit hawks of the austerity caucus was much stronger than it is now.
Well,
at least I'm hopeful. I can't guarantee that will be
no.
The outcome. I can't say that the White House won't again turn tail on this question, but I certainly hope that they don't.
Well, at least they seem to be taking a smarter negotiating strategy. This time around, he's already saying up front now, the president, that this is non-negotiable. So to that extent, I suppose that's an improvement. But
that's a great improvement, sure.
But still, you do have this enormous gulf between what the president said last week about the economy at the side of the famous Lincoln-Douglas debate and what the Republican budget, the outlines of which the New York Times have printed recently, which is extraordinary. I mean, not that the Ryan budget is not a harbinger of a kind of jihad against the government itself, but the idea that you'd cut EPA by about 40%, IRS by about 30%. This is the same people, by the way, the deficit hawks cutting the IRS. Is like, are they serious? Does anybody get it? I mean, that's my worry, that people don't.
Well, I think they are serious. We are looking at an extremist movement, which is fully in the hands of, let's say, a very narrow group of interest. I mean, who wants to cut the EPA? The question answers itself. Who wants to cut the Internal Revenue Service? Again, the question answers itself. This is not a difficult matter to figure out. So if you have a political party which is making its agenda these particular points, which are of interest to very small numbers of very powerful players, but who have interests that are completely against those of the overwhelming majority of the American public. The American public, after all, does want its environment preserved. It would like to have action against climate change. It would not like to have its water poisoned and its air poisoned. It does not want the full faith and credit of the United States government sacrificed. It does not want rich people to escape from tax enforcement. I mean, these are the longstanding, very stable attitudes on the part of the American public. And the American public is just going to have to decide if that's the position the Republican Party wants to take. What conclusions do you draw? Of course, it could turn all power over to the Republican Party in the course of the next presidential cycle.
Which apparently is the way it works, isn't it, in the midterms?
You know, if that's what happens, we will have to live with the consequences. But it's a fight that I think any reasonably well-led Democratic Party should be willing to engage on those grounds, because it's an eminently winnable fight.
In talking about a well-led Democratic Party, and of course they
I admit is a somewhat problematic proposition.
Well, I'm going to say, talk about grist for the mill, though. If they want to pick it up and run with it, the AP just published an advance indication of a study that's being done by a group of economists. That indicates that 4 out of 5 U.S. adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty and have to rely on welfare at least for some part of its life. They've come up with a different way to look at poverty in terms of economic insecurity as a metric. And it really throws into question the whole idea of the American dream and how well we're doing and we're recovering and all this stuff. I think the AP report and this study that's coming out, I think, to my mind, that is the reality. So how do you transfer that economic reality that most Americans are in, 80% of them who aren't doing well, into political action?
Well, I haven't seen the study, but if what it's saying is that 4 out of 5 have at some point in their lives to fall back on social insurance. It does tell you that everybody is somewhat precarious at one time or another, which I think most people know. But it also tells you that there's enormous value to having social insurance programs, and that having the capacity to support practically everybody at some point or another when they need it is an extremely valuable program, an extremely valuable, let's say, basis or a social system. And then again, we can ask, is the Democratic Party going to stand up for an insurance system on which 4 out of 5 Americans will rely at some point in their lives, whether that's Medicaid, whether that's unemployment insurance, whether that's food assistance, food stamps, whether that's, well, ultimately, practically everybody, of course, has some benefit from Social Security, so I don't know if that's in the study, but and Medicare as well. But the point being that a comprehensive system of support that catches a great part of the population at one point or another is a good thing, and one that a great part of the population both should support and, for the most part, does support, because it recognizes people understand that there but for the grace of God go I at any given time, and that there are many, many elements. If you have a small business, or if you have a factory job, or if you have, you're working in a fast food restaurant, or any kind of working in any kind of small business, these things turn over all the time, and people do need to have the support of a social insurance network. So I think you can, again, draw a very, out of the argument made by that study, which, again, I haven't read, you could make a very strong argument for a party based upon a program of mutual support and security. And that is not the that's not the Republican part platform. It has also been something which large parts of the Democratic Party, leadership of the Democratic Party, have been willing to compromise on, have been willing to make concessions about. One example has been this willingness to discuss changing the cost of living adjustments in Social Security so as to trim those benefits over time, which is a terrible mistake. And the Democratic Party should stand very firmly on the foundation that the social insurance framework should continue to be strengthened, and they should not be making compromises with people who would weaken it.
Well, but they can't make another terrible mistake and put Larry Summers in at the Fed, can they? I mean, Obama's going to lose what's left of his progressive support.
Well, let me first of all say the president's going to do what he's going to do. I don't want to get into the personalities of who should run the Fed.
Well, that's not my question, though.
I mean, yeah, I think it's a mistake to place too much importance on that institution. One of the things that we have, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been constantly turning to Ben Bernanke to be the guy who fires up the economy, and he doesn't have the tools to do it. And I think we've seen basically that what's called quantitative easing has had some very modest effects, but it really is not adequate to the problems that we have. And constantly referring back to the Federal Reserve as the kind of policy of last resort is a terrible mistake. So if Larry Summers should become chairman of the Federal Reserve, he's going to find himself, I think, in a backwater, really, in an agency which has got certainly some importance, but is not central to the problems that we have at the moment. It's interesting as to why he actually wants the job, that, of course, is for him to answer rather than for me.
Well, but the QE2s and 2, 3, 4, or whatever, the quantitative easings, are only a symptom of the gridlock in Washington. If the president, if the Democrats could win back the House and increase their lead in the Senate.
The QEs are a device for supporting the balance sheets of the banks by replacing assets that are very problematic, many mortgage-backed securities, with cash and with assets which are basically Tier 1 capital that have very firm value. And so it does that. It may have some effect in lowering, it may have had some effect in lowering the long-term interest rates, which is good for solvent households trying to refinance their mortgages. So we can give it some credit for that. But between those two things, you are not getting very far toward a policy of refloating the whole economy. Now, the notion that there's some magic in buying back in the buying up by the Federal Reserve of bank assets, I think it's mysterious to me as to what people thought it was going to accomplish.
Sure. Well, I was going to say it's all happening in the absence of any real economic progress because of the gridlock, and there's not a lot the president can do.
One function of the quantitative easing was to take some of the pressure off of the president and Congress to make concrete proposals. Oh, we have the Federal Reserve with this other policy.
Right.
Well, the other policy is basically a placebo. It's not accomplishing anything.
Right.
And it basically, as I say, removes some of the pressure on the other players.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, James Galbraith.
My pleasure, as always. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, a professor at the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas in Austin, and the author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the inside story of who the Muslim Brotherhood are.
At least it's not the end of the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carrie Wickham, who's a professor of political science at Emory University, specializing in politics of developing countries with a regional focus on the Middle East. Her current research examines the origins of political opposition in authoritarian settings, focusing on the rise of Islamic activism in Egypt and other Arab states. She's the author of The Muslim Brotherhood, Evolution of an Islamist Movement, and her latest article at the New York Times is Egypt's Missed Opportunity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carrie Wickham.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And to sort of summarize your article in Sunday's New York Times, my take on it, Carrie, was that, first of all, we don't know very much about the Muslim Brotherhood. We don't know about their history. We don't know about the age difference between those that began the movement and the younger generation and splits within the movement. So give us your summary, if you will, of all of the above.
Well, I think you're right to begin with the point that there is a tremendous amount that we don't fully understand about the internal workings of this very important organization in Egypt. You know, for good reasons, this is a group that has tried to stay under the radar to protect itself from repression and has been understandably reluctant to share information about its membership, its finances, and its leadership with outsiders. That being said, in the research that I've conducted over the past 23 years on the group, I have, come to the realization that this is a large umbrella organization that encompasses a wide spectrum of opinion. And we can discern three main trends within the group. The first is the old guard, which is an insular group of veteran leaders who are closely bonded by their long years of sacrifice for the movement, often having spent 10 or even 20 years in prison or in exile. And this is the group that has maintained control over the Brotherhood's Executive Council or Executive Bureau, from the beginning. And they tend to be quite ideologically conservative. That is, they still tend to support the application of traditional Islamic rulings inherited from the past, and also tend to remain very sort of aloof from and suspicious of outsiders. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we see what I call the reformist trend in the movement that has come to embrace more progressive interpretations of Islam that privilege ideas of pluralism, democracy, and human rights, and also have gained extensive experience interacting with secular democratic leaders and groups in broader spheres of public life, such as the professional associations, and come to see those others not as adversaries, but as potential partners in the broader tasks of political and social reform. And then in between those is an intermediary group that I call the pragmatic conservatives, who are closer ideologically to the old guard, but have greater experience in the wider political arena, for example, having served as Brotherhood deputies in Parliament for many years. And that group includes Mohamed Morsi, Sadiq Khatatni, the head of the Freedom and Justice Party, and many other leading figures in the Brotherhood today, in the public arena. And while we know that there are these different trends, what is harder to know is what level of support any one of those trends has within the organization, and why certain ideas gain traction among what types of members and why. That's something that we really still have very limited information on.
Well, what I learned from your article, though, Carrie Wickham, was that the three moderates that you mentioned, Assam Sultan, who was the Brotherhood's liaison, if you will, to the lawyers' syndicate,
mm-hmm.
Abul Fatur, who was a medical doctor, and then finally Mr. Mahdi,
right.
who was with the engineers' syndicate, they've gone off to form new parties. My recollection of the back to the election that elected Morsi was that there were other candidates that many saw as being more favorable in terms of a Brotherhood candidate. Were any of them on this liberal wing that you've identified here?
Well, what's interesting is that it was Azamin Abul Fatur, the figure from the medical syndicate, who early on offered to run as president and pitched himself as someone who could bridge the Islamist secular divide. But the Brotherhood senior leadership, regards him as ideologically, too progressive, too liberal in his views. And they ultimately threatened him with expulsion if he went forward in running himself as a candidate for president, which he had planned to do as an independent. And he, decided to move forward with that, and he was actually expelled from the group. And at the time, the Brotherhood's reasoning was, well, we promised that we would not run our own candidate for president. So if we supported Abul Fatur, we would be breaking our promise. But then, ironically, in the spring of 2012, the Brotherhood decided to run a candidate up from, within its own close coterie of ideological conservatives for the post of president. And what's interesting about that decision is that it generated tremendous debate within the Brotherhood itself, with the more reformist voices saying, we can't do this. If we run, one of our own top conservatives, first of all, we will have lost all credibility because we will be violating our promise. And, we're going to, create a lot of, dissension and distrust in the broader public. And the decision was put to a vote, and by a very narrow margin, the Shura Council, or the Brotherhood Legislative Assembly, decided to move forward with running a Brotherhood candidate for president. But as I say, that was a very controversial move. And you can imagine how different things might have been had the Brotherhood honored its initial promise not to run its own candidate, and instead had supported one of the what are known as the third way candidates, those that are clear alternatives to both the Brotherhood and the old regime, such as Abdelmadjid Abul Fatur, a progressive Islamist, or Hamdine Sabahi, a secular leftist Democrat, who together won more votes than either Mohamed Morsi or Ahmed Shafiq in the first round, but split the vote between them. And as a result, a figure from the old regime and a figure from the Muslim Brotherhood are the two candidates that moved forward to the presidential runoff. And, many people that I spoke to in Cairo in the lead-up to that election described the choice between Morsi and Shafiq as one between cholera and the plague. So many who voted for Morsi were not voting for the Brotherhood. They were voting against a figure associated with the old order. And in fact, if you look at the data, it looks like about half of the people who voted for Morsi in the runoff chose a different candidate in the first round. So his mandate from the outset was actually far weaker than many have been led to believe.
And of course, he was the last person to recognize that, apparently.
That's exactly right. He acted as if he had, the firm and, backing of a strong majority of the population, when in fact that was never the case. And what he should have done from the outset was to, you know, reach out to other sectors of the opposition under Mubarak, whether in the form of, you know, setting up a national unity government or encouraging key secular figures to participate in a cabinet, or including a broader cross-section of opinion on the commission set up to write Egypt's new constitution. But instead, he, chose to govern in close consultation with a small group of Brotherhood loyalists and gave the impression, rightly or wrongly, but gave the impression that the Brotherhood was using the powers of the presidential office for partisan gain, and that it was attempting to monopolize power. And, you know, I'm not sure if I fully accept that characterization, but neither did Morsi make a strenuous enough effort to counteract, you know, that impression.
And clearly the missed opportunity is what you just described, that the elections that elected Morsi as a fallback compromise candidate, and people had to hold their nose on at least on the secular and progressive side, the very people who brought about the revolution, because the socialist candidate narrowly missed the runoff, and as did the progressive Islamist candidate, Mr. Fatouh. So could you make the case that had that not happened, we wouldn't be having this violence in the streets today?
Absolutely. I think if the third way, which is those who best represent the spirit of the uprising, both on the, you know, both sides of the Islamist secular divide, because you have progressive Islamists like Abu Fatouh, who are deeply, I would argue, committed to the principles of democracy and human rights, but within an Islamic frame of reference, and then people like Hamdine Sabahi and other secularists, and those are figures and groups that could have worked together, and that, in retrospect, should have joined forces and run one of them as president and one as vice president, and, you know, some sort of formulation, but run together against the forces of the old order and against the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think in that case, they would have won. I mean, again, if you look at the data and you add up the percentage of votes that they received together, it is significantly more than what either Morsi or Shafiq won on his own. And yes, we would be in a completely different situation. But we would also be in a completely different situation if Mohamed Morsi, like Rashid El-Ghannouchi, who is the leader of Ennahda in Tunisia, had put the priority of national reconciliation first, rather than using the powers of his office to install Brotherhood loyalists within key agencies of the state, and, you know, give the impression that he was excluding other groups. But I'll mention one key difference between Egypt and Tunisia, which made the prospects for national reconciliation, or at least, you know, made it much more difficult to achieve in Egypt. And that is the strong presence of the Salafi current in Egypt. And it's important to remember that the group that came in second in parliamentary elections was not the secular democratic opposition, but hardline Salafi Islamists. And this, I would say, placed Morsi from the outset in a very difficult position after he assumed the presidency. Because on the one hand, he could not come across as being too concessionary to secular demands, because then he could be accused of having betrayed the Islamic cause. And at the same time, you know, he was being watched and scrutinized closely by secular liberals, who were quick to accuse him of attempting to restrict civil liberties in the name of religion. So when you have such a deeply divided society and such a broad ideological spectrum, with hardline Islamists on one end and secular liberals on the other, you can see that it becomes extremely difficult to forge a national consensus on the type of political order that the country should have moving forward.
Well, Kerry Wickham, though, the Al-Nur, the Salafist party, came out of nowhere, and in large part because of massive funding from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And it was also clear back in the original election that brought Morsi as a compromise candidate to the fore against a reactionary candidate. It's almost like that was working with the old guard's playbook, and that Morsi has simply fulfilled the old guard's playbook by being so boneheaded. And a lot of people are suggesting now that this revolution or counter-revolution was largely financed. In fact, one of the old guard Mubarak's owners of the media basically said he was responsible for Temurod, the group that got the, 22 million signatures on a petition. So how much is the old guard, the Mubarak era media, and the Saudis involved in reactionary politics?
Well, you know, it's certainly, you know, they say politics makes strange bedfellows, but it's certainly a very odd alliance, to say the least, between, you know, the conservative Saudi Islamist government, figures associated with the Mubarak regime, and, you know, in the form of media moguls and very wealthy businessmen, and then, you know, the secular opposition, the secular Democrats, who represent, you know, the genuine spirit of the uprising, which was, you know, a call for a democratic restructuring of politics and society, and a restoration of human dignity. So, you know, what do they have in common? Opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood, in opposition to, a sense of profound unease about the prospects of the Brotherhood assuming power, though for very different reasons. And I think that's a real, very important point, that, you know, many of the Mubarak appointees in the judicial establishment and in the military are less concerned with the preservation of, potential threats to democracy as they are to potential threats to their own prerogatives and privileges. So, you know, their concerns are very different than those of, you know, democratic revolutionaries who have risked their lives to enlarge the freedom, you know, enjoyed by all citizens in the country. So I think it's a problematic coalition that, you know, will very soon fall apart. It's already beginning to fray as secular liberals, people like Baradei, are looking at what the military is doing, using lethal force to shoot Brotherhood demonstrators in the head, and, you know, saying this is not what we wanted, and this is not good for the country. And I happen to agree with Bassam Youssef, who has been described as Egypt's John Stewart. I don't know if you're familiar with
him. Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, but he wrote a great article recently that I read, and in it he says, you know, I'm very disappointed in my fellow liberals. You know, you guys, we need stop gloating and start recognizing we all need to start recognizing the humanity in each other. You know, the Brotherhood, you know, supporters, they, you know, we may not agree with them, and Morsi may not have been terribly effective in power, but they are still a significant component of our society, and to demonize them is not only unfair but also puts our country at risk.
Well, of course, just to touch on the last point, though, the al-Nur leaders were standing shoulder to shoulder with General Sisi when the coup was announced. So, and I think they've lost quite a lot of respect, haven't they, or popularity, not that they had any traction with the liberals.
I think that both the liberals and the Nur party have, you know, lost a certain degree of democratic credibility by appearing to have, if not actively colluded with the military, at least tacitly endorsed the military's intervention that disrupted the democratic process. But at the same time, I think that the Brotherhood has to bear some responsibility for its own demise, because Morsi had numerous opportunities before June 30th, before the Temurod had, you know, planned these huge demonstrations, to de-escalate the tensions. For example, there was a major cabinet shakeup in May when Morsi could have reached out to leaders in the secular opposition and said, come join, let's join forces, and let's put resolving, you know, addressing the dire problems of the country first above any kind of partisan competition. And he did not. In fact, you know, the resulting cabinet was sort of more of the same, more technocrats and more Islamists. And I remember reading at the time that Amr Moussa, who is a key figure in the opposition National Salvation Front, said, you know, given the dire situation that our country is in, Mr. Morsi, don't you think it's time for us to set aside our ideological and partisan differences and join hands and work together. And my worry is that, and, you know, that opportunity may have been missed, at least for, you know, the foreseeable future, because the country's become so polarized now. The Brotherhood doesn't want to work with the secular liberals. You know, the liberals are gloating about their victory over the Brotherhood. The military appears to be on a witch hunt and is, you know, tracking down Brotherhood leaders and, you know, trying to basically incapacitate the organization. And the biggest losers, unfortunately, are the Egyptian citizens who sacrificed so much for their freedom and now face the needless trauma of a prolonged conflict.
Well, just in closing, Carrie Wiggum, I spoke yesterday with Robert Fisk of The Independent, who's in Cairo, and he was covering the demonstrations and saying that everybody holding up pictures of General Sisi seemed affluent and middle class, and everybody holding up pictures of Morsi were poor. And we've always heard that from day one, that the Brotherhood's real traction is in the poorer communities and in the rural communities, as is the case, for example, in Iran for the supreme leader and other conservative Islamists. So why is it then that the left in Egypt wasn't able to win over the working class?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a longer story, you know, that, you know, we have to sort of go back.
Well, we only got a minute.
Right. But, a couple things. You know, first, the working class in Egypt and the poor in Egypt are deeply conservative religiously, and for them, you know, a political message based on Islam resonates very powerfully. But I want to make, I think, an important point, which is, yes, the lower middle classes and lower classes have historically supported Islamist groups, but if you look at the people out on the streets, those millions protesting against Morsi on June 30th and the days that followed, many of them, if not most of them, were also from the lower classes, because they have been the ones that have suffered the most from the continued deterioration in living conditions that has occurred under the Morsi regime. So, you know, it was not, you don't get, there were not 30 million secular liberals out there protesting. Those were ordinary citizens worried about how to feed their families, concerned because they can't find jobs, distraught by the deterioration in, you know, housing and the rise in fuel prices and garbage piling up in the streets. And so, you know, what they have discovered, for better or worse, is that the Brotherhood does not have any magic solution to those problems. And if we can think of any positive, you know, things to come out of this crisis, you know, one can only hope that something positive comes from it. It's that it brings the Brotherhood, you know, onto sort of a more level playing field with secular groups, and now maybe we can see a more healthy competition between them for the people's support that is based on their ability to address their real-life problems.
So the temporal world intruded on the spiritual world.
Yes.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Carrie Wiggum.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Carrie Wiggum, who's a professor of political science at Emory University, specializing in politics of developing countries with a regional focus on the Middle East. Her current research examines the origins of political opposition in authoritarian settings, focusing on the rise of Islamic activism in Egypt and other Arab states. She's the author of The Muslim Brotherhood, Evolution of an Islamist Movement, and her latest article in Sunday's New York Times is Egypt's Missed Opportunity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.